The content of this program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. Hello, this is Shadate Hargett Hill from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. This is the fourth installment of five for the Oprah Magazine. We're going to get started with Live Your Best Life, The Beauty of Giving. Good spirits meet four devoted change makers, each on a mission to make the world a little bit brighter. Melissa Van Wyk, founder and executive director of Born Dancing. Inside a 247-seat theater located within an 88-year-old church in New York City, members of a dance company bend and stretch on a dusty stage. Many wear tights and tanks, and most have ditched shoes and socks. But unlike other troupes, this one isn't made up of only wispy ingenues a la Degas ballerinas. They're also tweens and seniors, wheelchair and walker users, and dancers with and without autism sharing space under bright lights. They're all part of Born Dancing, a nonprofit company for able-bodied and disabled amateur and professional performers formed in 2014 by Melissa Van Wyk. The Netherlands-born choreographer and dance educator got the idea while reflecting on her own training. The realization that I'd never been in a class with a visibly disabled person just stuck with me, she says. Of course, there are organizations for deaf dancers or those using wheelchairs, but I had more integrated vision. Born Dancing debuted its first original production in 2016, and this season will be staging its fourth and fifth. In addition to creating novel work, Van Wyk also leads dance education programs in underserved public schools and apprenticeships for teenagers with developmental disabilities who get to learn costume design, lighting, videography, and stage management. Everyone loves being on headset, Van Wyk notes. By the time we get to the show, she says, our pros, kids, and teens behind the scenes come together to make it happen. The growing group faces hurdles like finding affordable and accessible rehearsal space, but forges ahead with the help of grants, donations, and ticket sales to make art with high standards. Yes, we include people not typically seen on stage, says Van Wyk, but that doesn't change what we ask of our dancers or what we produce. Performances that make you laugh, cry, and think. With Melissa, it's not about your disability, it's about your ability to dance. That is from Madison Fieris, performer with Born Dancing. Another one says, all everyone wants to know is that they're not invisible and that validation can come from anyone. You, me, a mail carrier, or an uncle. That came from Valerie Weisler, who leads a workshop with 9th and 10th graders at a health and sports center in Ramapo, New York. In August, she talked about the Born to Dance. Valerie Weisler, founder and CEO of the Validation Project. When Valerie Weisler was 14, she stopped speaking. Weisler had been a gregarious kid, but when her parents announced their separation a week into her first year of high school, her confidence evaporated. I thought, if I don't say anything, nothing else will go wrong. Weisler's silence resulted in daily ridicule from a cruel crew of girls. They called me mute and told me to stay home, says the college junior 20. It was like a bad teen movie. Weisler tried to remain invisible until the day she saw another student being tormented, says Weisler. I went up to him and told him, you matter, and it just woke me up. So I decided to start a lunch group for outsiders and bullied kids. That 2013 gathering became a global movement called the Validation Project. First, we show kids they have unique skills, says Weisler, who's led more than 300 empowerment workshops in schools across the country. Then we teach them how to use their abilities to solve a problem in the world. So far, she's built a network of 1,500 volunteer mentors, including engineers, doctors, and artists, who show teens how to channel their interests, like cooking, toward a positive change, like a soup kitchen for refugees. Helping young people use their passions for social good benefits the bullied and the bullies, because if we give the latter a different way to feel big, maybe they won't want to make others feel small. The Validation Project's reach continues to grow. It has now worked with 6,000 kids in 105 countries. Still, Weisler, a 2017 L'Oreal Paris Woman of Worth honoree, reads each message the organization receives. At the core of every note, whether it's from a 17-year-old in Oklahoma or Peru, it's a desire to be heard, she says. I always want to be the person on the other end of the email, because 5 years ago, I was that student. Sonia Magid says, when I see in their eyes that new information is being processed and then they start smiling, it fills me with joy. Sonia Magid, co-founder of Code and Content Academy. For Sonia Magid, Black Panther's tech-savvy setting, the fictional country of Wakanda, isn't all fantasy. The co-founder of Code and Content Academy, a nonprofit that develops the computer proficiency of minority children in kindergarten through 12th grade in underserved New York City communities, recalls the effect of a field trip to see the film. The kids were blown away when they learned it was inspired by real-life African countries that are rich in natural resources, some of which help support the tech world. I wanted them to be empowered. She says, it's important for these children to see people who look like them doing cool stuff in technology. People like her, Magid, is the communications manager of social media for Audible, a company that produces audio entertainment. In 2015, while working remotely at her local library in Brooklyn, she noticed a dozen or so people of color waiting to use the public computers. Many of the adults, she learned, were unemployed and didn't have up-to-date skills, and the children weren't learning computer science in school. Magic decided to address that inequity, and the next year started Code and Content Academy to help create a talent pipeline to help begin at the grade school level that might one day lead to more minorities in high-paying tech industries. The organization brings volunteer experts into community centers and schools to teach kids programming languages, app development, and social media know-how. We also focus on content because many of the students don't necessarily see themselves as software engineers, she says. Magic's goal is not just to build the students' computer aptitude, but also get schools on board. When we do a workshop and it motivates a principal to say, wow, I see that kids are engaged and there's a need, so I'm going to apply for a grant to get more laptops and have your program here regularly. That's gratifying for me long term, she says. Magic loves being a cheerleader for the children as they gain real world skills to help them succeed. My biggest reward is tapping into their potential and showing them that they can, she says, Wakanda forever. Gigi Blanchard said, a lot of people ask the incarcerated, what's wrong with you? Instead of asking the right question, what happened to you? Gigi Blanchard, founder and executive director of The Kite. At the beach, a kite is a brightly colored object that glides on the wind. Behind bars, it's less magnificent. a colloquialism for a message passed between inmates. Having done time herself, Gigi Blanchard created her game-changing program, The Kite, as a structured and supportive means for incarcerated youth to share their life experiences. Blanchard's own story is complicated. The product of a troubled home, she was charged with car theft and cycled in and out of prison from ages 16 to 19. Ironically, it became her safe place. When I had freedom, my life was at risk because of the things I was doing, she says. Jail sounded better. There was food and a place to sleep, and I found my tribe. Eventually, her boyfriend's aunt helped Blanchard think differently about her options. She went on to college, and after presenting a very personal thesis on the juvenile justice system, something clicked. Once I told my story and let it all out, I felt like it was such a weight had been lifted, and I didn't have to hide. Today, 12 years later, Blanchard is playing it forward, paying it forward with The Kite, an ongoing writing workshop that gives incarcerated people a voice, encouragement, and a sense of community. Mainly operating at Rikers Island Jail in New York City, The Kite helps teens and adults express their stories on paper, as well as perform them open mic style. They'll also eventually see them published in The Kite Zine. At the start of each course, it's all about getting the hesitant and shy to open up. In the end, with Blanchard's mentorship, it's about healing. My trials and tribulations kept me on a self-sabotage mission, but I got to Gigi's class and realized that there are people who believe in me, says alum Dorsine Sims. And as Blanchard has proved, when people believe in you, really believe in you, you might even take flight just like a kite. Now we move on to Dear Lisa. Voices carry. Dear Lisa, my friend Susan and I have become lunching regularly and taking turns picking up the check. She's well off, but I've noticed she's very cheap. She's a very cheap tipper. If I ask for a separate check, she'll wonder why, and I don't want to insult her. If I sneak a few dollars to the waiter, I'm afraid I'll get caught. What do I do? Josephine from Indiana. Hey, big spender. Perhaps you can finesse this so that you don't have to insult a friend or cheat a waiter. By finesse, do I mean lie? You bet I do. Tell Susan you just read something about restaurant workers that really woke you up to how hard their jobs are and how much they depend on tips. Don't make it a big deal. Simply explain that from now on, you'll need a separate check because you intend to be as generous as possible. But you never dream of imposing your plan on her. Then glide gracefully into another subject, like how nice it is to know that your food isn't being handled by a waiter with a grudge. Dear Lisa, I grew up with a very critical mother, though I am now a 38-year-old dentist with a thriving practice and a wonderful husband and two terrific sons, I still hear her voice in my head telling me I can't do anything right. Can I ever stop it? Maddie from Texas. Dear Maddie with the mama issues, let's take a little quiz. Do you have bubblegum pink shag carpet in your bedroom? Is someone forcing you to read Beowulf? Are you devastated that Scott Handler made out with Suki Goldman at Rick Lieberman's pool party? If you answer no to these questions, then you are a grown-up. At this point, the only one filling your head with negative thoughts is you. So I can't help wondering how come your mother's distance perception is more valid than your present truth. What's keeping you from accepting the fact that it is a fact that you have built a life of love and purpose? Don't you deserve to be happy? Give yourself a break, sweetie. Even Suki Goldman questions her talent and worthiness from time to time, and she had Jennifer Aniston hair. Can you ever stop that voice? I don't know, but you can definitely make it a lot less real by keeping in mind that you're not a reflection of your mother's judgment. Look at your husband, your boys, and the freshly flossed gums of a terrified patient as proof that you do plenty right every single day. Dear Lisa, I dropped by the office on Saturday to see whether I left my ring there. I found the ring, but I also found my coworkers, Harry and Cheryl, not their names, having sex on the conference table. We all shrieked and I ran out the door. Luckily, we're not in the same department. Should I tell a supervisor or do I just pretend it never happened? Mara from New York. Mazel tov, Mara. It takes a strong woman not to pluck her eyes out with a spork after that kind of trauma. If I could, I'd send FEMA to your place with soup and blankets. First, though, a few words to all the Harrys and Cheryls out there. One, know that if one of you is a boss to the other, you're both playing with fire. Number two, remember that businesses are entitled to monitor anything sent or received on their equipment. No email should ever begin with a detailed reminiscence of that special night when you were the ambassador to Luxembourg and he was but a lonely shepherd. And speaking of monitors, you'd be surprised how many offices have hidden cameras, which brings me to number three. Avoid all public displays of affection. This includes getting your boink on within 40 feet of the copy machine. Number four, were you raised by wolves? And if so, did the wolves tell you to have sex at work? No, they did not. And that's because wolves use studio apartments with futons until they can afford larger places with queen-size beds. It's called nature. Look it up. Mara, if you were in a managerial position, you'd have a duty to report the incident since this could become a case of sexual harassment, leaving your company potentially liable. It's also lucky you're in a different department because if Cheryl were your boss and Harry your colleague or vice versa, then you'd constantly wonder whether you were receiving equal treatment. But it sounds like Harry and Cheryl are just a couple of people who've somehow managed to convince themselves that their naked bodies are good enough to handle fluorescent lighting. There's no perfect answer here, but either way, I'd go out and buy a giant container of Clorox disinfectant wipes in fresh scent and scrub that conference table like I was Lady Macbeth. Lizzie Cogan is O's writer at large at the author of Someone Will Be With You Shortly, Notes from a Perfectly Imperfect Life. We're moving on to Love That, great buys under $100, minimal effort. Since the holidays are approaching us, this is great. Want to keep it clean? Try unfussy modern silhouettes in an understated palette. Victoria Beckham is a style icon as she walks around Paris in a plaid dress with burgundy boots and a burgundy bag. For $85, Anne Klein has the perfect watch. Fashion meets function with the elegant embellishment-free rose gold watch. Anne Klein, Amazon.com/fashion. A tie belt waist and high-low hem freshen up classic checkered pants. JDWilliams.com, get them for $68. And the Luxe Low and trendy yet sensible kitten heel instantly elevate pants, skirts, and dresses. CharlesKeefe.com for $79. Soft hues and breezy shape make this seasonless plaid skirt extra feminine. And Zara, $75. And again, the style icon Victoria Beckham has another outfit that she is wearing, a plaid skirt with a plaid shirt as well. You'll never go wrong with gold hoops and a flat design in a swanky update. Gold hoops for $68 at IndiaHicks.com. and fitted on top and flowy on the bottom, that standout asymmetrical dress is both polished and figure flattering. At Lane Bryant for $70, lanebryant.com. The inverted collar and notched lapel create stylish flair in a peacoat. Stylish flair, oldnavy.com for $70. And layered or solo for work or weekends, a tweeded top goes the distance and taylor.com. And from what to wear to what to put in your house, Adam's Home Style Sheet. It's a plaid world. Rustic finds will keep you and your cute critters in check. Lead the Chase, a dog leash for $35 at llbeam.com. Perfect Shot, picture perfect frame for $85 at house.com. Bowl Me Rover, food and water dish from $14 at paperproductsdesign.com. Take a pause, Hudson Pillow Cover, $99 at williamsonoma.com. Snooze Dog Pet Bed, $168 at jcpenney.com. Mutts and Hounds, throw it out there, squeaky bone toy from $24 at muttsandhound.co.uk. Stag Party, Bucky Deer Bus Plaid Wall Decor for $51 at wayfair.com. Rough Rider Pet Carrier for $243 at lovemydog.co.uk. And In For A Treat Biscuit Tin for $17 at harrybarker.com. And now we're moving on to feeling good as the holiday is ending for Thanksgiving, that is. We want to talk a little bit about Test Your Diabetes IQ. The facts you don't know about type 2 diabetes can hurt you. Take this quiz to stay on top of your health. Number one, you may have pre-diabetes if you have the following. If you have which of the following? A, frequent urinary tract and yeast infections. B, low energy. C, a persistent urge to urinate in the middle of the night. D, cavities and dry mouth. E, dark velvety skin patches around the neck. Answer, all of them. A staggering 84 million adults have prediabetes, in which blood sugar is elevated but not high enough for a diagnosis of type 2, yet 90% of them are completely unaware of their condition. The signs can be tough to spot, as chronic high blood sugar affects all parts of the body. I don't think people recognize how bad they feel until after they've received treatment, says Katie O'Sullivan, MD, Assistant Professor of Adult and Pediatric Endocrinology at the University of Chicago Medicine Clover Diabetes Center. Number two, at what body mass index or BMI can you develop diabetes? 18.5 to 24.9, normal weight, 25 to 29. 0.9 overweight, 30 or above obese. Answer, again, all of them. In a 2016 study published in the Annals of Family Medicine, nearly 1 in 5 normal weight adults aged 20 and older have prediabetes. A more revealing marker than BMI is waist circumference. 35 inches or higher is a major warning sign. People with larger waists tend to have more visceral fat, the kind located around the organs, which is a greater risk for diabetes, says Robert A. Gabway, MD, PhD, Chief Medical Officer at Joslin Diabetes Center. Ethnicity matters, too. Asian Americans have up to a 50% greater risk for diabetes than non-Hispanic whites, even at lower BMIs. Number three, what surprising things can you do to avoid diabetes? A, schedule a lunch date with friends. B, quit drinking coffee. C, turn off TVs and tablets a few hours before bedtime. And D, stay out the sun. Answers, A and C. A, schedule a lunch date with your friends. And C, turn off TVs and tablets a few hours before bedtime. Recent research shows that individuals isolated from family and friends are more likely to be diagnosed with the disease. While the biological pathway has yet to be discovered, it may be due to the toxicity of stress or an elevation in cortisol levels, says O'Sullivan, both of which are buffered by social connection. She also points out that sleeping less than 7 hours per night, perhaps because of TV's blue light, can disrupt insulin regulation. Did you guess B? Actually, a Harvard School of Public Health study found that people who increased their Java habit over 4 years by more than a cup per day and average lowered their odds of developing diabetes over the following 4 years by 12%. Number four, what do you need to do before getting a blood test to screen for diabetes? A, abstain from eating or drinking for 8 hours. B, nothing special. 3, walk for 30 minutes. D, drink a super sugary beverage. Answers, B, nothing special. Screening always used to require a fasting blood glucose test, which meant you couldn't eat or drink anything for about 8 hours prior. Today, you can get a diagnosis via a simple A1C test, which measures average blood sugar levels over 3 months and requires no prep. FYI, 5.7 to 6.4% is the pre-diabetes range. 6.5% or higher is diabetes. Number five, true or false, diabetes can be cured. Answer, false, but it can be put into remission. If diabetes is mild and caught early, you may be able to make lifestyle changes, including diet and exercise, to help you lose weight and improve your insulin response so you can come off medication, says O'Sullivan. In fact, a 2017 analysis published in the journal BMJ noted that for overweight or obese people, losing an average of 33 pounds can put blood sugar levels into the recommended range, a big step on the path to great health. And here's a note, 1.5 million Americans are diagnosed with diabetes every year. 84.1 million Americans are 18 and older have prediabetics. Are pre-diabetics in 2015. And now we turn to the section on the reading room. The Reckoning, Idra Navi's electrifying latest, Tyranny and Male Privilege. Those Who Knew, Viking is a literary takedown of the more dangers of dictator-style leadership hiding behind the rhetoric of values. By turns, brutal, funny, and tender, the novel masterfully intermingles scripts, letters, and traditional prose to create a slick bullet of a book whose target is absolute power that corrupts absolutely. The novel encompasses a wide range of characters. Olga's an ex-radical, weary facing the indignities of aging and loss. Lena and Christina are single mothers, uneasily united by their shared bond with Victor, a powerful and predatory senator, and Freddie, Victor's younger brother, is a playwright secretly satirizing the so-called Truth and Justice Party, the TJP. In the aging port city of an island nation near the start of the new millennium, the TJP has replaced the roundly criticized Cato regime that disappeared during the terrible years. These include Olga's murdered lover, to whom she composes letters in her Marksville bookstore, which doubles as a pot dispensary for the pale tourists visiting from the northern country. As the story unfolds, the women come into their own in their attempts to topple the rules, especially Lena. In a family that maintains a stubborn alliance to the inhumane government policies that line their pockets, Novi makes a striking point about the mistrust that is the legacy of a divide, how much safer it felt to withhold anything close to trust in a country as bitterly divided as her own, during what are arguably our own terrible years, with truth and justice blurred nearly every day. Those Who Knew is an urgent as a tickling time bomb. The Secret Garden. Tanya French's new novel is an intriguing blend of whodunit and who am I. This is a story about murder in a literal family tree. The witch elm of the title looms over Ivy House, the Hennessy's ancestral home. When they gather for tea one spring Saturday, a skull is found hidden in the hollow of its centuries-old trunk. These are not good times for the Hennessy's. Toby, the golden boy, has suffered a series of personal and professional setbacks. First, he nearly loses his PR job at a gallery over an art fraud scandal, but his boss decides to keep him on. He celebrates his lucky break by going out drinking with his chum. When Toby later stumbles back to his apartment, he surprises a pair of robbers who beat him so badly he's left with severe head trauma. Too unsettled by the attack to stay in his flat, Toby moves to Ivy House, hoping to recover in a soothing place and spend time with his Uncle Hugo, who's dying of brain cancer. For a short while, peace reigns. Then there's the gruesome discovery in the backyard, and the novel shifts from poignant family drama to breathless thriller. Who among the relatives is capable of murder? Until now, Toby has remembered his childhood as wonderful, idiotical. However, his cousins have a very different recollection of summers at Ivy House. As the detectives uncover clues, Toby searches his own unreliable memory and is unable to make the case for his innocence or anyone else's. Fans of Tanya French's Dublin Murder Squad series know her to be a high priestess of tense, twisty plots. But in The Witch Elm, she travels a new path, exploring the complexities of identity. While the mystery's resolution is astonishing, it is not the emotional center of the tale of loyalty and his shadow twin resentment. Hugo's illness presages and changing of the guard, forcing the cousin to reexamine everything. Death can coalesce as a family or tear it apart. It turns out that it's especially true when that death happens to be a murder. Coming of age. In his searing debut memoir, Casey Gerard contemplates the price of success. There will be no miracles here. Opens with a climatic loss of faith in a Dallas church on New Year's Eve 1999 as a 12-year-old Casey Gerard waits in terror and expectation for the second coming of Christ and the end of the world. It doesn't happen. He feels foolish. It will be the first of several crises of belief. We are immediately launched into an author's impoverished youth and its all too familiar particulars. Addicted father, mentally ill mother, long-suffering sister, rendered in vivid, painful, and regularly funny reminiscence. But more than anything else, this is a weary document of American class strata. During Gerald's earliest days at Yale, where he plays football, a dean advises him not to wear his fitted baseball cap around campus, as the look is so stereotypical, she tells him. You don't have to do that anymore. As Gerald ascends to maneuver among the elites, get a job at Lehman Brothers, works as a prestigious think tank, meets two presidents, he keeps the raw sensitivity and sensibility of someone who's felt like an interloper all his life. The gay black boy raised in the church, the Rose finalist who admits not finishing a single book during college, the Horatio Alger character who doesn't just wonder what his rise was for, but asks whether the rise itself and any system that prescribes and necessitates it is pernicious. When a friend from college commits suicide, Joe breaks down. He writes of a world that subdues us, makes us strangers to ourselves, so that we can be recognizable to others. The book has no answers. It's the work of a young man searching for the first time in his life for the right questions. The Oracle Years for author Barbara Kingsolver, Art and Activism in Lynx. Since 1988, when her first novel, The Bean Trees, came out, Barbara Kingsolver has been writing fiction and essays that wrestle with big themes, false patriotism, zealotry, climate change among them. The Poisonwood Bible, her 1998 masterpiece about a missionary's destructive hypocrisy, was an Oprah's Book Club pick and sold more than 4 million copies. Her latest, Unsheltered, is also a sociopolitical novel tackling real-world issues, especially how we humans navigate profound changes that threaten to unmoor us. Its alternating timelines feature strong women and men confronting ignorance, disloyalty, economic instability, and their own limits, and sometimes painfully, sometimes joyfully, learning to adapt. You'll cry reading this book, but Kingsolver is also downright hilarious. She doesn't let her heroines and heroes mope for long. O's Books editor, Lee Haber, asked her how she pulls it off. Lee Haber, do you start a new book with a certain character in mind? Barbara Kingsolver, I usually begin with a question. In this case, how do people behave in times of great upheaval? Lee says, and then Barbara says, I imagine a falling down house and two sets of families who would live in it a century and a half apart, each figuring out whether they could embrace the chaos around them instead of being crushed by it. Lee says, so the house is a metaphor for that? Barbara says, exactly. For the historical plot line, I chose the 1870s post-Civil War era when the country was polarized, much as it is now. On top of that, there was the introduction of Charles Darwin's theory of evolution, which was hugely disorienting to those who believe humans had sprung fully formed from Adam and Eve. Lee, Mary Treat, the heroine of the 19th century section, was an actual person who corresponded with Darwin and was fascinated by the behavior of spiders and carnivorous plants. Barbara, yes, Mary was my lightning rod. Lee, she was fearless in her quest to understand the world and didn't seem to care what people thought of her. Barbara, much of what I have her doing in my novel is drawn from papers of hers I stumbled on in Vinland, New Jersey, where the book is set. They were a gold mine. As a scientist, she made so many important findings, but to this day, few know about her. Lee, and in the present day chapters, Willa and her husband and kids live in the house. They personalize and encapsulate what so many of us feel right now. Barbara, yes, I invented a family coping with crises in every direction. Willow's a science writer whose magazine has gone under, and she has no nest egg or plan B. Her husband is a professor, but the school where he's been teaching closes down. Their grown son has staggering college debt and is trying to figure out how to care for a baby after his partner dies. And their daughter is chronically underemployed and has come back home to live to a house that is literally collapsing around them. In other words, the backdrop is our current reality, which I wanted to look at close up. Lee, Willa and company are being rocked to their core. Barbara, yes, and they're starting to wonder, did we reach this point because our assumptions about the world were mistaken? Willa and her husband have followed all the rules. So then why, they ask themselves, aren't things better now for us and our kids? They've accepted certain preconceived societal notions as immutable, like their laws of physics or gravity. What do people do, I thought, when gravity stops working? Lee, Willow's other struggle is with her own relevant. Barbara, we anchor ourselves to our utility. I harbor a pretty primal belief that people gain happiness from being useful. Writing gets me out of bed in the morning. Willa doesn't have that anymore. And she's also begun to realize that yesterday's people can't solve tomorrow's problems. And she's a yesterday person. Lee, but she's also a doer, and she finds some interesting ways of pivoting. Plus, her marriage is totally hot. Barbara, we hear all the time that marriage is a failing institution, so I like the idea of portraying a modern relationship that was going strong in many ways because the two people in it have given each other permission to be themselves. Lee, you open the book with a line from Wallace Stevens. After the final no, there comes a yes, and on that yes, that future world depends. Barbara, that's what it's all about, isn't it? When you reach a point where it all seems impossible, it hits you that, as Mary Treat puts it, without shelter you are standing in daylight. The Furies, Rebecca Traster's previous book, All the Single Ladies, revealed how women who've bypassed our cultural expectations have reshaped America's socioeconomic landscape. Her cathartic Good and Mad is something of a spiritual successor. It casts our recent revolts, hashtag MeToo, Black Lives Matter, the March for Our Lives, and the Women's March among them against the larger protests, rich backdrop of our country's history behind every great movement. Traster, contend, has been a woman whose ear served to ignite monumental change. Traster draws a line from Emmett Till's mother, Mamie, who invited the media to her son's open cast funeral and is credited with sparking the modern civil rights movement, to Bree Newsom, who in 2015 scaled a flagpole at South Carolina State House to take down the Confederate banner. Traster interweaves the tribulations of today's firebirds with those of the past. The result, a celebration of a catalytic force that burns ever brighter together. And last week, we were talking about the gift that was especially sweet, something marvelously kind, fabulously helpful. And on these pages, they're talking about heaping helpings of gratitude. And we left off last week about gratitude, reading some articles about gratitude, some inserts, and we're going to continue with that now. Dear Public Library, I love you, not just because there are wild roses, which I can literally stop and smell growing all around your little stone self, or because your chilled entryway is shelved with pay what you like discards for rummaging through, or because of your nerdy owl logo. I love you because your librarians are so kind to me with my excessive enthusiasms and my daily pals at the circulation desk and my overdue notices. It looks like that book on fermented cashew cheese was due back 2 weeks ago, but no worries. But also to the down and out folks who pass some time with you, to the kids with nowhere else to go. They are even nice to the teenagers vaping in the self-help stacks. My teenagers vaping in the self-help stacks, for all I know, blowing smoke into the books on how to quit smoking. My kids have been coming to you, dear library, since they were babies. When you hosted Tuesday baby music class with Happy Dan, back then I passed the lonely hours reading parenting books and eyeballing other moms in a weird, hitting on them kind of way, while my little pawed a book boards played with your train set and contracted norovirus from stuffing the caboose into their mouths. Now ordering coffee at the cafe across the street from you, I run into your children's librarian. She's storytelling pretty. She is storybook pretty with angel hair curling auburnly around her angel face, and I blush. Does everyone treat you like a celebrity, I say, and she laughs. Your librarians keep all our secrets. Like bartenders, we never tip. They know that I checked out 7 books about perimenopausal rage. Then I use interlibrary loan to request a book called Mating in Captivity that I put a hold on, both a memoir about microdosing and a study of conjoined twins, Chang and Aang. I keep your books, and they're overdue. And I'm sorry. And the librarians, those gracious hosts, would never be so crass as to mention what I'm costing them. Also, they cheerfully lend me Gospels and collables and glossopials, and I have borrowed all of them. I am especially grateful for your books. Novels are the pool and palm tree that I am always crawling through the desert toward. I read with my headlamp on, long into the night, those sweaty, sleepless, rage-filled nights. You enable this habit, bless you, and save me approximately $11 trillion in the process. And sometimes, as I'm checking out, a librarian will gesture towards this or that cover and say, oh, that's a good one. And I flush with happiness the same way I do when a waiter praises me for ordering the short ribs, because I'm needy. Because you meet that need in so many ways, even if there's no portrait of you in the Anna Leibovitz coffee table book you lent me. Even if you're not featured in any popular neuroscience book about feel-good brain chemicals, you are the hero of a story, and it's this one. That came from Catherine Newman, writer in Amherst, Massachusetts, where her beloved Jones Library has all four of the books she's authored. Dear IRS auditor, I know you're not expecting this, but thanks, really. If you hadn't mistakenly overcharged me in the fall of 2012, I might never have woken up. I'll admit it was a huge shock to the day I opened the unassuming white envelope containing your final assessment to find I owed $50,000 as opposed to the few hundred dollars my accountant had predicted. Then again, I hadn't spoken to the guy in months, maybe a whole year. That was how I was then, utterly checked out. At the time, I was grieving the sudden death of my 22-year-old daughter and moving in protracted slow motion. I was so devastated that I closed my marketing coaching business and was living on savings in the pastel comfort of a friend's guest room. Each and every day, I woke up and laid there staring at the ceiling, not sure how or why to get out of bed. You seemed like a nice young woman when I picked up my files from your suburban office. The unmarked white door nearly obscured by a Gargantuan American flag hanging limp on a pole. Standing there in jeans and a flannel shirt, you asked, "Do you have any questions?" I was so terrified to be on the IRS's sterile, fluorescent lit turf that I couldn't think clearly. I could barely think at all. But finally, I remembered a couple of critical queries. Had my accountant ever discussed my bill with you? And who'd calculated that my business earned $200,000 more than it actually had? You were downright empathetic when you said, "We called your accountant, but I'm afraid he never got back to us." Money had always been an intimidating blur to me, and the IRS a fearsome, shadowy giant. But that day, I decided to go through the appeals entirely on my own. In the weeks that followed, I slowly assembled page after page of deposit slips, invoices, receipts, and counsel checks, tucking them carefully into a massive three-ring binder. As I did, something shifted in me. The process has shown me like an invitation requesting I return to the world of thinking adults, and it felt surprisingly good. When the appeals officer looked over my handiwork months later, he was impressed. "These are Wall Street quality books," he noted with a smile. After a few hours, he called to inform me, "You made an error. I owe nothing." Molten relief and pride poured through my limbs. I was awake again, moving forward. Thanks to your mistake, the long, slow slog of grief eased just a little, allowing me to discover an unexpected truth. I had been through hell, but I was going to be fine. That came from Suzanne Falter, writer, blogger, and host of the podcast, The Self-Care Soother. Dear Tiny Balled Up Fist, the first time I saw you was on a screen in my midwife's office. You were tucked under my second baby's chin. Past my due date, I wheeled you, and the baby attached to you to evacuate the premises immediately. When my water broke a few days later, I was thrilled and terrified. My two-year-old son slept soundly in the next room, and memories of my first C-section and my fear of another surged inside me in the delivery room. I bounced for hours on that damn birthing ball, but no matter how much I jostled myself, I never dilated beyond the size of a Skittle. My baby would not budge. Hours were spent with my own fist tucked under my chin, contemplating my options. I waved my white flag and was wheeled to the operating room for another C-section. On my side of the curtain, draped across my torso, I trembled and cried. Then I heard the cry. The doctors lifted my baby above the curtain, and I saw both her fists balled up in anger over their immense disturbance. She was placed on my chest, and I was stitched up. I stroked her back and held you, her tiny fist, in my hand. I brought you to my face for the first of many kisses. When my daughter was born, I didn't see her on the other side of the curtain. I didn't know that the umbilical cord was wrapped tight around her neck several times, but she tucked up all five red wrinkly fingers wrapped in a miniature palm under her chin beneath the cord. You protected her. You kept her airway clear. Without you, things in that bridge operating room could have gone terribly, terribly wrong. Now 3 years old, she still sleeps with you under her chin. Her other hand lovingly cradled a stuffed giraffe. When I smooth back her blonde hair to nuzzle her forehead as she falls asleep, I'm reminded of how thankful I am for you. Those red, wrinkly fingers are now pudgy and fair, with a palm that's becoming adept at petting our rescue mutt. I smile when she gives me an ebullient high five, remembering the enormous gift one small hand gave me. Sarah Farrell Baker, Maryland-based writer, mother, and blogger at NoPurpleWalls.com. This is Heart to Heart. We all imagine opening up to those who have supported us in hard times. Here, two readers will verse in the challenges and joys of mother-daughter relationships actually going through. Dear Mom, nearly 30 years ago, Tony Parker gave her mother, Beverly, the shock of a lifetime when she had a baby at age 15. Tanya hadn't told her mother she was pregnant until she went into labor. Along the way, she hid her growing belly in oversized clothes. In the decades since, she and Beverly have become very close, and Tanya, now 45, a school counselor and author of Virginia, called her mother to express her thanks for her unwavering support. Tanya, Mom, ever since Dad passed away, I've been thinking about saying things to people we love while we still have time. The Oprah Magazine asked the question, who would you like to thank? And I picked you, Beverly. Oh, Tanya, I share with them a story that you don't ever really talk about. That when I was a teenager, I hid my pregnancy from you and Dad out of shame and fear. The day I went into labor, I told you only that I needed to go to the hospital. And after you drove me to the ER in the parking lot, I handed you a note saying I was about to give birth. I was too afraid to say it out loud. I've heard that you almost passed out. Beverly, I nearly did, yes. I remembered. Tanya, I know you realize I was in a lot of pain, but you didn't know why. I'm sure that must have been scary. Beverly, it really was, but wait, I want to apologize to you. I feel like I was horrible for a while after that because I was embarrassed. I was pretty upset that you were pregnant as a teenager. Tanya, but you were always by my side. I feel like I didn't appreciate you, your support, the way I should have. You made so many sacrifices. I mean, you took a night job so you could watch the baby while I was at school. I only missed 2 days. Still, I do remember the look of shame on your face when people would ask you about me. Beverly, I wish I could ask you to forgive me for being so angry. I wish I could change that. Tanya, I understand why you felt the way you did, and as I got older, you became my biggest supporter and my closest friend. Through my divorce, everything, I wouldn't have my master's degree today if it weren't for you. You bought me a car and you put money in my bank account many times. You showed up. Beverly, you were strong. You always have been that way, and I'm incredibly proud of you. You did a lot for me as well, and I want to thank you. I love you to death. Tanya, you always say that. I'm your rock, but the truth is you've always been mine. I'm where I am because of everything that happened. I wouldn't trade it for anything. Dear daughter, digital content creator Natasha Brown and her eldest daughter, 14-year-old Alicia, live in South Carolina. On the road of life, the two have encountered plenty of speed bumps, including frequent moves, financial strife, and even a brief bout of homelessness. Now a married mother of four with a fifth on the way, Natasha wanted to express her appreciation to Alicia. If you look at her today, you'd never be able to guess everything that we went through, she says. I need to thank her for being brave, even when it wasn't her job to be. Natasha, listen, I really wanted to sit down and talk to you about the things we've experienced as a family over the last few years. I feel like you've had to struggle unnecessarily, like things were hard on you when they shouldn't have been. Do you feel that way too? Alicia, I don't think I had to struggle so much as I had to sacrifice. I had to help out a lot. That's not to say I shouldn't have had to help out, but I've had to do a lot. Natasha, I feel like you didn't get a chance to be a kid the way you should have. Over the years, we had to move so many times. You were in several different elementary schools. Still, you adapted to every situation. You showed an incredible amount of resilience, more than I did. I want to truly thank you for putting up with everything. Watching you has made me a better person, a stronger person. It's put me in a position where I'm going to make sure we never fall back into that hole again. I've noticed everybody's noticed how much you've grown, how you've kept your grades. You're exemplifying everything we've taught you and then some. I couldn't be any prouder. Alicia. Thank you. Natasha. I didn't mean to make you cry. Alicia. I'm not crying. I'm just thankful. Thank you. I like that you said all those things to me because I feel like sometimes I should hear them. At the same time, you've always been there. I can talk to you and we can just chat and stuff. You're there for me. Natasha. As parents, we should thank our kids more often. I want to make a habit of it. I want you to know how much I appreciate you. And who's on your gratitude list? Asked to express your appreciation, you happily tipped your hats to stepmoms, strangers, and a Supreme Court superstar. At Ray Takes Off, my parents for absolutely everything. At Lindsay Benjaminez, the notorious RBG, I can't thank her enough for her life's work. At Dr. D.L. Jones, my biological mother who gave me away at birth, it took me many years to realize that what she did for me was the highest form of love. Sometimes you love someone enough to know you need to let them go. At Osu Soccer Girl 10, my inner child, she carried the weight of this adult on her shoulders for 3 decades. At Vision_Board_Maker, my typing teacher, Mrs. Pressure, even though she gave me detention all the time, 32 years later, I still make a living with the skills she taught me. At Deandra.White5, my 6-year-old granddaughter, for keeping me humble, the truth that comes out of her mouth. At SpeechTeach86, the gentleman I met in high school who'd had a laryngectomy. He patiently explained how he learned to communicate without a voice box, which inspired my 30-plus year career as a speech-language pathologist. At Kieran Caller, my father, Carlos Charles, when my mom died from a brain tumor at age 38, he became a single parent to 4 girls, ages 5 to 10. He taught us about love by the way he took care of my mother and us. At Tracy Swatson, honestly, my trash and recycling collectors. At Posnagram, my 3 godsons, goddaughter and nephew, for teaching me that while I don't have children of my own, I can still teach, love, and nurture. At Ava J. Gomez, my cousin who was the surrogate for our twins. Now 7 years old, she volunteered to take on the job without hesitation. At Gigi Carranza, my sweet 10-year-old dog, Lola. She is my constant reminder to pause, cuddle, and love. And thanks to my 3 children for not getting angry that I wrote about Lola and not them. At M.M. Isaac 2, my ex-fiance. Had I not found out the day before my wedding gown fitting that he was cheating on me, we would have gotten married and now I'd be divorced, miserable, and feeling unworthy. I met my future husband later that year and will soon celebrate our 20th anniversary. At Shelly C. Summer, my stepmother, for being the only family member brave enough to suggest that perhaps I wasn't cut out to be an art history professor. She was absolutely right. We've run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Shadate Hargett Hill, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. See you next time on the radio.